Welcome to this Thursday edition of Main Street. I'm your host, Craig Blumenschein. In the second half of today's show, Matt Olien stops by our Main Street studios to review the summer surprise blockbuster movie, Inside Out 2. And Dave Thompson and I will review this week's news. But first, we'll get an idea on what it's like to take your bike out for a ride as we visit with Jason Orlowski, who just completed his second day across Minnesota, 240-plus miles of Minnesota gravel roads by bike. And he did it in a single day. Jason Orlowski, welcome to Main Street.
Thank you.
What causes a person to want to ride his bike more than 200 miles in an endurance event, which is what you did in the day across Minnesota?
This desire actually started in, I think, around 2018, 2019. I was getting into cycling. I'd been into, running and fitness for a while, and I'd heard about this crazy gravel bike race called the Day Across Minnesota. I learned about it while I stopped at a local bike shop. I thought, hey, it sounds pretty cool. It sounds like something I'd like to try. But I really didn't do anything about it until 2021, when I heard that, the Day Across Minnesota was going to end. And 2021 was actually going to be their last year. So I thought, okay, it's now or never. So I wanted a gravel bike. So I went and picked one up, got it modified and fitted for me. And then, did the first day across Minnesota in August 8th of 21. It was hard. It was real hard. I hadn't trained well for it. I didn't have a good fueling strategy. I finished, but I kind of paid the price. So I looked at it from the standpoint of, okay, it's a win. But then they ended up bringing it back this year in 2024. And I really struggled with it, whether I should do it or not, because I've also started doing triathlons and some other events. But I figured, can I do it better the second time around? And so after some consideration and some talking to my wife, who is also my support crew, throughout that day, I decided to sign up for it, got in, and finished it for the second time, an hour and a half quicker than the time before.
And an hour and a half quicker seems fast to me.
Yeah, it was 19 hours and 55 minutes was my finishing time. And I mean, it was a fast day all around. It's a long time. And it starts at midnight, which is a challenge in and of itself, because you're up all day on Friday. And I tried to take a nap and just to get ready for what was to come. And I didn't sleep so good. So, the adrenaline when the fireworks goes off at midnight to indicate the start of the race, that only stays with you for so long. And right about 3 o'clock, 4 o'clock in the morning, I was getting real tired. But then, of course, once the sun came up, woke back up again, and I just kept on going.
How many riders started the event?
They cap it at 500 can sign up, and about 415 showed up. I think about 320 I actually finished.
Jason, you said you got a gravel bike. What's different about my normal road bike or somebody's mountain bike with a gravel bike?
Yeah, so the gravel bike, quite a few similarities. I would say the biggest difference, at least the one that I picked out, is the frame is just a little bit longer than my road bike. And then especially around my tires, the tires are a lot wider. I still run tubes in my tires, so I want to make sure that I have enough clearance for those tubes. But really just wider tires to help take on the gravel. Some days you got really packed down gravel, like it's going to be almost like riding on the road, and other times, freshly graded, it's going to be really loose and you sink into it.
Were you on a trail?
Gravel roads the entire way.
So like farmer's roads?
Farmer's
roads. Out of the country.
Yeah, out of the country. I saw a lot of corn in the time, but the western part of the state was definitely more cornfields. The farther east you get, you run into a few more forests. So it gets scenic later in the day, but it also gets a lot more hilly the farther you get into the race.
What does your mind tell you when it's 3:30, 4 in the morning, it's in the dark? You probably have maybe a headlamp and a bike light,
yep.
I'm guessing.
Yeah.
And you really can only see a real small, limited place about where you're going. And by that time, the peloton, so to speak, is really spread out.
Yeah, and actually about 3 o'clock in the morning, I found myself alone. There was a group in front of me that went around the corner, and I got ahead of the group behind me. What I thought was real cool is there was a meteor shower So I spent more time looking up at the sky than I did looking at the road. And I hit a couple of big rocks, so I got jarred a couple times. But you got to take your mind off of it somehow. So I was just watching the shooting stars that were going on that night. Also, and you got to keep yourself awake. I found I was really starting to fall asleep while pedaling. I didn't think that was possible, but it is. And I just had to keep my mind off.
You didn't make a right turn and end up in Wisconsin or something like that.
No, I didn't do that. I think right turn right into the ditch. But then you're also following. I have a little GPS tracker on my bike, so you just follow the line.
Just like your car.
Yeah. Yep.
Left turn ahead.
Yep. Left turn. A right turn. And in this route, the longest distance that you go on any one road was 18 miles. So you got to pay attention to, you may go a mile or half a mile on a certain road, then you got to turn again. So you got to be constantly looking at your GPS, make sure you're not going off track.
Do you have any trouble with your bike along the way? And flat tires come to my mind, but there are also mechanical things that can go wrong.
Yeah, thankfully this time I put new tires on. The old tires are getting a little thin and I didn't want to have...
Are these Kevlar line tires?
No, these are a little bit thicker walled, but they were wider and thicker than my last ones. Just because I didn't want to have a blowout. I can change a tire. I'm just not fast at changing a tire. But later in the day, I think I just had a lot of gunk and gravel building up around the rear cassette or where the chain goes around. Because sometimes I would shift up or shift down and wouldn't lock into gear right away. And you'd feel the chain just like jolt when I finally did. When I did it in 2021, I actually crashed about halfway through the day and had a mechanical where it wouldn't go into the lower gears. Thankfully, you find people are alongside the road basically the entire route, helping other, being support for their riders and sometimes helping others. And there was a guy with a bike stand, and I said, "Hey, can you help me? This thing is not shifting anymore." And he goes, "Oh yeah, here's your problem." And he popped out these rocks that I couldn't see, and then just sprayed things down. I was on my way in like a minute and a half. But yeah, mechanical is always on my mind.
Do you listen to music or listen to audiobooks, or can you do that, or is that dangerous to do?
On the gravel, you can do it. I don't do it so much on the public roads, just so I can hear what's going on around me. But yeah, I was listening to, what's the name of it? The Jocko Podcast. So I was listening to the Jocko Podcast. I have Audible books. I'm not really big on listening to music when I ride. I like the conversations more to kind of keep the mind engaged.
Enjoying our conversation with Jason Orlowski. He completed the day across Minnesota, over
243
mile bike ride. That's the distance that I drove to college when I was a freshman at the University of Wyoming from my house, and I hated that drive, and I was in a car. There are people that really were fast with this ride.
Yep.
You finished in under 20 hours. What won the race?
11 hours and 16 minutes. Yeah. And then I think the second place person was like 11 hours, 36 minutes. There were some incredibly fast riders. There was another Fargo rider who finished in 13 hours. It was just a really fast field. The weather had a lot to do with that, with tailwinds that helped push you along. So
I've read that there are races that are double this distance.
And there's the day across Minnesota, which is 243, but they
that's
also
the dam.
Yep, the dam. Then they have the double dam.
Right.
Where basically you get to Hager City, Wisconsin, that's on the Minnesota border, and you turn around and you come back on gravel roads that are usually about a mile south of the route that you took there. And only five people did that total.
Right.
Where in 2021, they had probably double the number.
And so in 2025, is that on your bucket list?
It is not. You know, I think there's some other events that I'm looking at, whether it be northern Minnesota along the North Shore, maybe in Wisconsin, somewhere in there.
Tell me about your training. When you first decided to do this, I mean, we live in Fargo. You're maybe last winter, you could have gotten out more than you had thought you might be able to, but how do you train for this?
Yeah, in some days it's tough because life gets in the way pretty quick. There's really not a good training plan for this. So I took there's a 200 mile plan that's online that I just took and modified. But I do have a trainer bike in my basement, so I can jump on that at lunch because I do work from home. So I have the benefit of that. or at other odd hours, whenever the mood strikes to jump on it. And then just around Fargo here, both north and south, there are some really good roads. I always make it a practice to pedal into the wind to start my day and then let the wind carry me back home. So
yep. A marathoner will maybe train at half distance. And if you, I've read, never have done one, that if you can do half of a marathon in training, you can likely do a marathon on game day, so to speak. What's the practice for someone who's going to ride 247 miles?
The training plan, you know, calls for 150 miles. As your max ride. I did not do that. I got to about 110 that day, and I kind of ran out of time. The way I look at it is if I can get a few longer mile days in a row, that will help quite a bit. You kind of make up that distance. And for a while, I was doing about 300 miles a week just to get ready for it. I didn't have a long training time because I came off of the half Ironman in Des Moines beginning of June and then had to go right into preparing for the dam right after that. So I didn't feel I had enough. Didn't have a lot of time to get ready, but I was able to get in some good long rides.
In a triathlon, is biking the strong part of your triathlon versus swimming or running?
I would say, biking would probably be the first one and swimming the second. I didn't start swimming until my 30s. I'm almost 50 now. But I found that I have a really just constant pace so I can just keep on going.
For people who have run a marathon, if people have done what you did on the bike, do you have a sense for what's more difficult?
No, I've done a 50-mile run before as well, and I think the run is harder for me than the bike. Yeah. I think the bike you have more, I don't know, I just find the bike a little bit easier to go than the running part.
I mean, my layman's approach to that is you can coast every now and then on a bike, and you can never coast while you're running.
Yeah, you can walk when you're running, you can kind of pedal slow, but yeah, I find the biking just to be easier than the running.
What about nutrition, first leading up to the race and then during the race? How did you handle that?
Yeah, my first time, I definitely didn't handle it very well. I was doing a lot of gummy bears and just sugary type foods, which didn't work out so good for me. But the second time was peanut butter jelly sandwiches, wraps, a lot of protein, a lot of electrolytes being taken while I go. I love these little goo chomps that you can get at Shields or any really outdoor store. They're little 100-calorie packs that you can just tear the top off and eat it real quick. So I made it a point to make sure I had something in my gut every 40 minutes or less. If I was climbing, I would do it more. If I was just on a flat road or more downhill, I wouldn't need as many calories, but just made sure I kept fluids coming in and food coming in. Every stop, have something bigger. My wife had wraps and peanut butter and jelly sandwiches, a fruit for me. But leading up to the race, unfortunately, I'm a chocolate lover, so I guess you can't outrun your bad habits, but I do love chocolate. Trying to eat fruits and vegetables on a regular basis, keep the proteins coming in, and just try to balance it.
In retrospect, would you change your training at all after this second round with the dam?
If I could have started riding longer earlier, I think that would have helped, but there's not a lot I would change other than that.
Bikes, oftentimes, you pay for ounces being lighter and lighter and lighter, and then the cost goes up and up and up. Was the weight of your bike a concern when you purchased your bike?
Not really. I actually tried two different bikes, and I actually bought the heavier of the two because I just felt it was a better ride overall on the gravel road. So,
are you clipping in?
I do clip in. Mm-hmm. Yep, I do have clips.
Did you ever worry that you couldn't react quick enough when you hit a big rock or something, and that's just part of the game?
It's part of the game. I've tried to unclip quick and put my foot down several times. I've fallen, do the fall of shame when you can't unclip quick enough and you just do a slow fall to the side. But
where I've fallen on bikes is on gravel, making turns.
Yep.
Any close calls for you?
I did have one close call. We were coming around a corner and thankfully there was a guy standing at the corner. He was just stopped for a second and he yelled to us, "Hey, it's Sandy." And so as we were coming up to the corner, everybody slowed down real quick and rolled through the sand. And you could see skid marks where people had slid out. I've slid out before as well, but you know, thankfully he called that out, so we didn't have that happen.
When you see road races like the Tour de France and other things that you see on television, is that something that interests you, or is gravel your game?
Both. I do like watching the Tour de France. I love watching the Olympic road race.
If you can explain to me some of those races that they have, is it called the Pelodrome?
Oh, yeah, the tracks.
I don't follow
that as much. I do like watching the teams, team ones, but not the individual. I guess I don't understand it enough to...
Yeah.
But when they do get going fast, it is fun to watch. I know the first couple are real slow.
What kind... Give me a sense of the bike community here. To me, the reason I asked that question is it's coming from where I came from in Cheyenne. I could take off from my house. I could ride out and back more than 20 miles and never be on a city street. They took their trails very seriously. But here I don't sense that as much, that it's a bike first kind of thinking community. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, I would agree with that. There are some really good roads that have wide shoulders, like the road out to Horace or out to Kindred. Those are pretty well traveled because you got wider shoulders, you can move over. Same if you go out to Oxbow and even south of Oxbow a little bit. But you really got to pay attention to which roads you ride on. Otherwise, you're right on the white line. And I have these tri-eye glasses so I can see what's coming behind me. They got a little rear view mirror. There's also a Garmin make something so you can see what's coming behind you. It tells you on your screen. You just got to have a lot of spatial awareness of what's coming on.
What do you take from this when you complete a race like that?
You're capable. You're probably more capable than you realize you are. So take this as an input into what's next.
What's next?
Yeah, that's a question I'm asking myself right now, actually. There are some big bikepacking races that are multiple days that would be interesting to try. I've never done a bikepacking, so.
What's bikepacking?
Where you literally have everything is right on your bike, tent, sleeping bag.
These are multi-day races?
Yeah, multi-day, self-supported, so.
I know there are races across the country. I had a friend who attempted one when he turned, I believe, 50.
Okay.
He started in the Pacific Ocean and made it to essentially his home in Lander, Wyoming, and that was it. And that seems like an awesome accomplishment to me, but of course then he didn't make it to the Atlantic Ocean.
Yeah.
Going through, you know, elevations of 12,000 feet or so at 2 or 3 in the morning when you're in the world of grizzly bears and things would play with my mind.
Yeah.
Does that interest you at all?
It does. I think it'd be fun to be in those areas. Yellowstone is a place I'd love to cycle through, though the people that have done it say, don't worry about the animals. It's the drivers that are dangerous. I would love to do something out there like that, where you can bike pack, really get out of town and see something unique that you don't see every day.
Just a pro tip. Before the park opens in Grand Teton National Park, which is just south, the Park Service allows only bikers and hikers on highways. Before they open to cars around, I think it's around April 1st or so.
I think I saw that, yeah.
And it's just beautiful.
Yeah, yeah. If the roads are passable. I'd love to go up Beartooth Pass sometime and try that.
It's a beautiful drive. I'd like to be on a bike, but it would be great.
Yeah, I've heard a rumor of, yeah.
So, any more Ironman? You've done a half Ironman? Have you done a full?
I've done two halves. I don't know if I would do a full. I actually enjoy the speed that you can go in a half Ironman.
And tell us the distances of a half.
Yeah, a half Ironman is a 1.2-mile swim, 56-mile bike, and then a half marathon.
Which is about 13 miles or so?
13.1. So it's 70.3 miles total, and a full Ironman is double. And I've had a couple of people tell me that the Ironman is actually easier than the half Ironman.
I find that very hard to believe.
I do find that hard to believe. I've heard it from a couple folks, and I said, I don't know if I'll test that theory. But I do enjoy the halves because at least after the event's over, I can still walk pretty well.
How did you feel when you completed, when you crossed the finish line? How did you feel?
I feel like you're floating. You feel great. You know, you've done something big that the 99%+ of the population won't do or can't do. So it just gives you a confidence boost of what else can you accomplish? You've done something big. I admittedly don't dwell on, I finished, I feel great about it. I'll feel great for a couple of weeks. And then right away I start thinking of, okay, let's put that one now to the back burner and let's look at what's coming up next.
For someone who's never done something like this, they're listening to you and they're thinking, what would you tell them?
Start small. It's an adventure. I'll say in 2005, I had a health scare because I was actually way overweight. I had high blood pressure. The doctor said, hey, if you don't do something by 45, you're going to be big, big trouble. So that's where I started to do just a little bit of exercise, get out a little bit, started small, started working my way up. Then somebody said, hey, do a 5K. So I ran a 5K and then I did my first bike event and then another and another. And so as you make these small steps, you realize what you're capable of. So then you take the next one and it's a little bit bigger. And okay, I did it. Now I'll take it a little bit bigger. So I just encourage people, don't limit yourself because you're stronger than you think. So just, again, start small. You don't need a $4,000 bike. You can start with something small or something cheaper and you start working your way up.
And there are people out there who will support you and your endeavor.
Oh, absolutely. I give kudos to anybody who's just getting out there for the first time. So
Jason Orlowski completed the day across Minnesota, rode his bike 243 miles in under 20 hours. Congratulations.
Thank you very much.
And thanks for joining us on Main Street.
Thank you very much for having me.
Next, Harvest Public Media reports on raw milk, which has seen a rise in popularity in recent years. More than 30 states allow for its sale for human consumption in some form, including North Dakota. But food safety officials have long warned of risks with drinking unpasteurized milk. Now, a recent outbreak of bird flu in dairy cattle has raised new health concerns with consuming the product. Harvest Public Media's Skylar Rossi reports on what that means for people producing and drinking raw milk.
Scott Moser pulls glass jars of raw cow's milk from one of the coolers against the wall of a refurbished shuttle bus.
Welcome aboard. Need more milk?
Yes.
Let's do it. How are you today?
He greets many of his customers by name as they board one by one carrying colorful cooler bags and grocery sacks. Scott and his wife Rachel Moser own Bee Holigan Farm in Excelsior Springs, Missouri. The operation sells about 700 gallons of raw milk per week. One of their loyal customers is Tara Huffman. She has been drinking raw milk for more than a decade.
It's a superior product. That's really what it comes down to. We have followed Scott kind of all over Kansas City. He has so many drop-offs.
Customers can't get this milk inside of a grocery store under Missouri law, which is why the Mosers and their team make more than 40 weekly stops across the Kansas City area. Raw milk is chilled straight from a cow and doesn't undergo the heating process that pasteurized milk does. Every state has different regulations around how or whether it can be sold. While many of the people drinking raw milk say it's healthier and even makes them feel better, most health experts say there are risks to drinking it. Cornell University Dairy Foods microbiologist Nicole Martin can name a long list of possible pathogens.
We know we can find Listeria and Salmonella, E. coli, Campylobacter, a variety of different types of bacteria that can make people ill.
And now the emergence of bird flu in dairy cows is raising more concerns. Testing shows that bird flu is present in sick cows' milk. There's no evidence yet that humans can contract the virus through drinking raw milk. But Martin says bird flu in dairy cattle is new, and there are unanswered questions about how the virus can spread.
We don't know enough yet to say there is no risk, and therefore the approach at this point is there should be increased caution.
The U.S. Food and Drug Administration is encouraging states to monitor or even halt the sale of raw milk products. Still, the demand for raw milk is strong. Recent data from market research firm Nielsen IQ found that sales of raw milk have increased despite recent bird flu cases in dairy cows and the FDA's warnings. In Iowa, fourth-generation dairy farmer Jay Schonbacher says news of the virus caused a slight dip in his raw milk sales in May, but they've since recovered. with bird flu cases in the state. He says he's monitoring his herd, speaking with his vet each week, and he's increased biosecurity measures.
The last thing we want to do is give raw milk a bad reputation, right? So, you know, we don't want people getting sick from our product. We're doing everything we can to make the product healthy.
In Missouri, where there have been no bird flu cases in cows, the Mosers say they are consistently seeing new customers place orders. Rachel Moser says the farm closely tests milk from each quarter of each cow's udder. She says the farm is her livelihood and her customers are like family. She even names some of her cows after her longtime buyers.
Most of my customers, they trust that we are doing everything in our power to keep our product extremely safe and that we're vigilant and that they trust that we've got their best interests at heart.
Moser says many of her customers are more worried about state officials stopping the sale of raw milk than they are about getting sick. I'm Skylar Rossi, Harvest Public Media.
Harvest Public Media is a collaboration of public media newsrooms in the Midwest and Great Plains, including our newsroom here at Prairie Public. After the break, Matt Olien reviews the summer blockbuster movie Inside Out 2. Is it better than the first in the series? We'll find out after this.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Starion Bank, determined to provide smart banking solutions with innovative checking accounts and personal banking tools that match your lifestyle. Starion, taking you farther. Learn more at starionbank.com.
Welcome back to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein. It's time to go to the movies with our weekly movie reviewer, Matt Olien. Matt, welcome back to Main Street.
Hi, Craig. How are you?
Here's the clip from our movie today, Matt. Inside Out 2.
How was camp?
Come on, it's the apocalypse!
It was good.
She goes away for 3 days and all we get is good?
She goes away for 3 days and all we get is good?
Yeah, sounds right.
Ask and answer.
Back to the game.
Riley is officially a teenager now.
You aren't packed yet?
I'm the worst!
Overreact much?
I barely touched it.
Let the professional handle this.
I'm too gross to go anywhere ever again!
Well, that's a preview of the next 10 years.
On June 14th.
I'm Anxiety. I am just such a huge fan of yours.
We're Riley's new emotions.
Wow!
Remember when we all finally came up to headquarters?
Nostalgia.
That was like 30 seconds ago, nostalgia.
Yeah,
we just heard the clip of the movie Inside Out 2. Matt, how does this compare to the original film? Is this one you liked?
Yeah, I liked it. I finally went and saw it, and I have to admit, as my kids have aged and kind of aged out of animated movies, I've stopped seeing them as regularly as I used to. I'm not one of these, you know, I have many friends that just love animation and they're obsessed with it. They go to it. It's amazing to watch. The Spider-Verse films have been amazing, but I just kind of have to force myself to go, and I know it's a huge film. So I decided, well, let's review it this week. Yes, it's very good. It is not as good as the first one, I don't think, because I always say that spark of inspiration of an original is hard to top. Godfather 2, of course, remains the benchmark for sequels that might be slightly better than the first one. But this is good because what they do now, and Kelsey Mann takes over directing from Pete Docter, who directed the first one. He's now in charge of all creative stuff at Pixar, Pete Docter is. This one now, Riley, the little girl, is 13 years old. So we fast forward from 2015, the last time we saw her. Now she's 13. She plays hockey. She's going to a hockey camp. She has friends. She's a really good player. But suddenly, what about age 13, Craig, with a teenage girl? Yes, puberty is on the horizon, and angst and anxiety. So now, not only do we have the five emotions from the original film, joy, sadness, you know, all the emotions we had, now anxiety comes in, played by Maya Hawke. Anxiety is the new emotion, and she is joined by envy, embarrassment, and ennui, which is kind of the boredom emotion, played by Adele Exarchopoulos, the great French actress from the movie Blue is the Warmest Color. She's the one that talks like this. Oh, I'm so bored. That's a new emotion. But anxiety, voiced by Maya Hawke, is really the new key emotion that Riley deals with. And anxiety in the movie fights with joy. Joy is, of course, voiced by Amy Poehler. Sadness by Phyllis Smith. She kind of was the breakout voice actress from the first movie. And so in the film, that's essentially the battle. The battle is between anxiety and joy, and kind of this teen angst. What does Riley do? Does she try to impress the older girls on the hockey team and ditch her friends? These are all things that happen. And as a father of a teenage girl, I can tell you that, you know, these emotions are real. And, you know, the child changes dramatically from about age 13 through 16. And so that drives the movie. And I think that's why it's become so popular with parents and their kids to go with, is this battle in Riley's brain between anxiety, joy, sadness, embarrassment, all these things. And I am surprised this film has become the all-time money-making animated movie. I did not see that coming this summer. I knew it would be a big hit. But it tapped into something out there, $642 million domestic. It's grossed $1.6 billion worldwide. Wow. I did not see that coming with a sequel. Even as great as Inside Out was, it won the animation Oscar. I did not see that coming. But clearly, it's tapping into something within the inner emotions of teenage kids. And that's driving the audience. I went last week, Craig. And this film has been out for months, and it was packed. It was late on a Friday afternoon, and it was packed in there. So it's definitely hit on a chord. I don't think it's as good as the first one, but clearly it's certainly the early front runner, I think, to be the animated Oscar winner this year for 2024. We'll see what else comes out. But I would recommend it. I think adults will like it as well. It's pretty frantic. You know, basically, it kind of goes back and forth, the action between Riley playing hockey and being with her friends versus all the emotions inside her head fighting with each other, trying to get Riley back to a point where, you know, joy and sadness and all the emotions kind of remember her as the little girl they remember who's now fighting. There's a great line in the movie, and this doesn't give away anything, where Joy says, "I give up. I can't fight anxiety." And that is, I think, that line hits home with parents. Boy. It's got to hit home with parents and teens. I'll give Pixar credit. They had teenagers as advisors on this movie about emotions. They had psychologists as advisors. So they really have done their homework in terms of tapping into a teenage focus group as to the anxieties that these kids feel. So it's not adults imagining what the emotions are.
Matt, I had an NDSU professor tell me earlier this week in the interview that we had on Main Street about death bots that what you see trumps what you hear, and science backs that up. So in this movie, even though it was animated, did the visual style and I guess the animation techniques work well?
Yes. So if you've seen the first one, it's the same visual style. The emotions are in her head. They're swirling around. They're constantly hitting the control buttons. Oh, now she's sad. We got to hit sadness, you know. So the animation is exactly the same as the first one. When I say it's not quite as good as the first one, it's not because of the animation. It's not because of the characters. I like that anxiety is the new emotion, the new main emotion. But the animation is the same. I just don't know if it quite has the spark of inspiration as the first one. But the animation is amazing. And really, this gets Pixar back on their feet, Craig. They've had a couple films in the last couple years that haven't done as well as, you know, kind of their heyday of the, you know, late 2000s through the late 2010s, when they had that amazing run of Up and Inside Out and Zootopia and all that. They really had a run there. This is their biggest hit now in a while. And as I said, it's the biggest grossing animated film of all time. But yeah, the animation is amazing, and it will keep you engaged through the hour and a half you're sitting there.
Do you think we're going to see an Inside Out 3, Matt?
I would sure think so. Is Riley a high schooler at that point? I don't know what the plans are, but with $1.6 billion gross, I'm not sure I think that basically answers your question. Yes, there will be an Inside Out 3, and I'm sure Pete Docter and Kelsey Mann and everyone at Pixar is already working on it.
Do you know of any additional animation films we're going to see this season, Matt?
Oh, I knew you were going to ask me that. I like I said, that is not my wheelhouse. I'm not sure what's really coming. I can definitely check that out before next week when we talk, and I'll be watching a non-animated film next week. But this is certainly, I would think, the front runner right now, but I can check and see what's coming later this year.
What other reviews do we have coming here at the end of summer, Matt?
So I think there's a couple coming up at the Fargo Theater. I don't know which one I'll see first. Blink Twice with Channing Tatum, and It Ends With Us with Blake Lively. Alien Romulus is on my radar to see. And, of course, we got Beetlejuice right after Labor Day. And I do want to see Francis Ford Coppola's Megalopolis, which will be in theaters in late September. Now, as you know, or maybe don't know, the word of mouth, the reaction at Cannes was very mixed to Coppola's film. I mean, there were a couple people that saw it over there that said, I can't believe this guy has won an Oscar for Best Director. It was so bad. But it's his passion project, and it's Francis Ford Coppola, so I am going to see it and just see, is it misunderstood or is it really that bad? That's going to be really interesting to see what Megalopolis does at the box office.
I really want to see Beetlejuice. Can't wait for that. And Matt, Blake Lively has had to go on the defensive here just a little bit.
She has. There was some rumors of on-set discord with It Ends With Us with Blake Lively and the director. They were not doing press together to promote this film. But, you know, I have some friends that have seen it already, kind of mixed reviews, but we'll see what I think. But yeah, on-set discord is what we're hearing from that movie.
All right, let's get to the trivia, Matt.
Okay.
You think that Inside Out 2 certainly will not win a Best Picture Oscar. There have been three animated films nominated for Best Picture, but none have won. Can you name them?
Beauty and the Beast, 1991, Up, 2009, and Toy Story 3.
That's right, Matt.
Is that it? Okay.
We've been to the movies with Matt Olean.
Vice President Harris is set to wrap up the Democratic National Convention with a speech. Her remarks follow a week of high-profile appearances from party heavyweights and celebrities outlining their case for the Harris-Walz ticket. But as the convention comes to an end, the election is just 2 months away. We'll debrief on the night's headline speech on the next Morning Edition from NPR News.
Weekdays beginning at 4 a.m. Central here on Prairie Public.
Extra, extra, read all about it. Gather round, everybody. I'm gonna tell you a story.
There's the walkout music we like to hear once a week. Dave Thompson, Prairie Public's longtime director of news. Dave, how are you?
I'm doing well, Craig. How are you?
Dave, you're with us to review the news of the week. The North Dakota Department of Commerce is holding a North Dakota Global Talent Summit. There we go. And the Office of Legal Immigration has its hand in this.
Right. Now, this is an office that was established by the legislature back in 2023, sponsored by Fargo Democratic Senator Tim Mathern, who said, we need to bring legal immigrants to North Dakota because we've got a lot of job openings and we just don't have the people yet. They're probably willing to work and they're going to come here. What the Global Talent Summit was about is not only to have the jobs available, but to make them welcome when they come to North Dakota. That's really a pretty good thing.
Do you have a fix, Dave, on are we talking hundreds of people that the office would like to assist with bringing to North Dakota?
What I'm hearing, it's in the hundreds.
And I know that it's been relatively successful in the Bakken. Is that right?
That is correct, because they had that effort to bring Ukrainians to the Bakken. That worked very well. Now they're talking about expanding that legal immigration across North Dakota. There are jobs all open all over the place.
Speaking of the Bakken, Dave, two natural gas pipeline projects now could mean more use of Bakken natural gas.
Mm-hmm. Now, the one that I found extremely interesting was this crude oil pipeline that takes Bakken crude to Guernsey, Wyoming. They're going to convert it now to a natural gas liquids pipeline. Kinder Morgan's going to have this done by 2026. And that's going to allow, you know, use of natural gas, again, to prevent further flaring. And remember, Bakken oil is accompanied by natural gas. So if you have to shut back the gas, you're going to shut in the oil. So that's why they're looking for markets for it.
Pro tip here for those traveling ever to Wyoming. Guernsey, Wyoming is the home of the Fort Laramie National Historic Site. I think it is one of the great historic sites in Wyoming that we have visited several times. Dave, oil production dropped slightly in June, and you and I have talked about this for now seemingly several months.
Yeah, we have. There's been a goal by North Dakota Oil and Gas to get back to the 1.3 million barrels per day. Well, right now in the June, it was 1.175 million barrels per day. So it didn't quite get back to it. It was down about 1.9%. But they're thinking that was because of some natural gas plants that were out, and they didn't want to flare the gas, so they shut the wells in. Now, as these projects finish, the idea is that some of these wells are going to come back online. I think it's more part of the process. There is always a natural concern about it, but they're hoping that if they get back to 1.3 million barrels a day, that's going to be good for the state's budget. That's going to be good for oil production as well, and might attract some more drilling in the Bakken.
Speaking of the Bakken, Bakken oil eclipses oil from legacy wells.
That's something we've known for a while, but I thought it was stark to me that of the 1.175 million barrels per day, only about 30,000 barrels come from legacy wells, which is just drilling straight down. Now, the oil people are saying, you know, with what they've discovered in drilling in the Bakken, they're hoping that maybe they can get back to these legacy pools too and produce more oil out of it. But, you know, they say that, you know, the Bakken is a pretty big basket. It's a big oil field. So right now they're not really concerned about the fact that they're down to 31,000 barrels per day out of the conventional drills, but they're hoping to get that back up.
I love the comment. It's never really good that we put all our eggs in one basket. Mm-hmm. You know what? We've got a pretty big and good basket there.
Absolutely.
They have some sadder news to talk about. There's been a couple murders in the area, and specifically, your office has reported on the West Fargo police, who's now identified an individual in a church shooting incident.
Yeah, this was a strange one because it happened Saturday morning at Prairie Heights Church in West Fargo. And police were told there was an altercation that happened between three people, and there was a church shooting incident that left one man dead. It's a very sad story.
Dave, many of us watched a former high school football coach from Minnesota rise to the national stage last night as Minnesota Governor Tim Walz accepted the Democratic nomination for vice president. That's a stunning, really, rise for him and also our neighbor here, Minnesota. It's a big deal for the state.
It is a big deal for the state. And remember, it didn't happen all this long ago, very long ago, that President Biden pulled out and Vice President Harris was the nominee. And she was looking at a vice presidential candidate and went with Tim Walz, who probably will appeal to maybe some non-city voters and maybe some city voters as well.
Some middle-class voters and certainly wants to appeal to the Midwest. It surprised me, Dave, how good he was making the speech of his lifetime.
Yeah, it was interesting. And what was interesting is they used football players from where he coached high school to come out. I mean, this thing, and I hate to say this because I'm old enough to remember when conventions matter a little bit more. There were races at the convention. You had to go through the roll call to make sure who was going to get enough votes. Now, both the Republicans and Democrats have more of a four-day infomercial, which is okay because sure. they get to introduce themselves to the people and talk about some of their priorities, which is not bad, but, you know, we all covered it. We in the media covered it.
We all know who his kids are, Gus and Hope now, for sure.
Yes.
Dave, what's new in state political races? Things have kind of been on the back burner, it seems to me, for a little bit. Anything rising up?
Not yet, but I think, you know, our debates are coming up fairly soon. That's going to probably spark some interest as well. You know, it has been quiet because there's been so much of a spotlight on the federal races, on the presidential races. The one thing that I have noticed is a trend that a lot of these local races are becoming national races because they're using national talking points. Both parties are doing it. I'm not saying it's bad or good, but that's the way it is.
Wyoming had its primary this week, and the Freedom Caucus, the very much farther to the right caucus, had a significant and positive day. They gained 10 to 11 seats in Wyoming's 90-person legislature. So at least Wyoming is trending even more farther to the right. Might be interesting to see what happens here in North Dakota.
Yeah, absolutely. And there are a few competitive races, and Democrats here have been down for a while. They are not involved in every legislative race, but there are some races to watch, especially in eastern North Dakota.
Dave, anything new coming from your newsroom? Can you tell us what's on the horizon?
I'll tell you about a fun little story that I have. The director of the State Historical Society, I find out, is a big fan of the explorer, David Thompson. We have the Dave Thompson Memorial that is up near Velva. So I'm going to have a little fun with that story. I'm trying to have a little bit more fun to kind of lighten the load. So
I like that, Dave. Now, have you been to the Dave Thompson Memorial?
I certainly have. I have pictures in my office. I've been there three times.
I want a picture too, Dave.
All right.
We review the news each and every week here on Main Street with our news director, Dave Thompson. Dave, it's always a great pleasure to visit with you.
Thanks, Greg.
Gather around, everybody.
Did you know that when you support Prairie Public's radio service starting as little as $5 a month, you'll receive access to one of our best Prairie Public member benefits, PBS Passport. Passport lets you stream your favorite PBS shows on your Roku, Fire Stick, Apple TV, or Smart TV. Watch the programs you love all on your own time. Unlock entire seasons of programs early and discover new TV series, movies, and musical performances, all available to you when you support Prairie Public, your local NPR and PBS station.
This is Dakota Datebook for August 22nd. According to Lemoore County officials, the murder of Hans Bjorn was one of the strangest crimes in the county's history. Bjorn was a bank official. On the afternoon of February 28, 1927, someone came into the bank, murdered Bjorn, emptied the vault, and disappeared. Over $3,000 had gone missing. The killer left no clues, and the authorities were at a loss, but suspicion quickly fell on Francis Tucker. Tucker lived and worked on a farm near Verona and was in financial difficulty. A merchant had refused to sell him coal because his unpaid bill was over $100. Then the police learned that Tucker, just an hour after Bjorn was killed, paid his bill in full with crisp new bills and a few silver dollars. Over the next few days, Tucker spent over $800 using new bills and silver dollars. Part of the money missing from the bank included 100 silver dollars. Tucker's family stood by him. His brother-in-law, John McGill, pointed out that there were several cars in town on the day of the murder, and they had not been accounted for. Why hadn't the drivers of those cars been investigated? When asked why Tucker's explanation of where he got the money kept changing, McGill brushed it off, saying Tucker is such a forgetful little cuss. The case against Tucker was based on circumstantial evidence, but it was enough for a jury. He was found guilty of murder in November 1927 and sentenced to life in prison. He was released on bail, pending his appeal of the verdict. In December, his bail was revoked and the court ordered his arrest. Over the years, family and neighbors and Tucker himself filed appeals for a new trial, but those efforts were fruitless. Another appeal for a new trial claimed there was new evidence that could exonerate Tucker. The state argued that the time limit for such an appeal had passed. On this date, in 1931, Judge Fred Yanzonius agreed with the state and denied the appeal. Tucker's case came up before the parole board several times over the years, but he was denied each time. Today's Dakota Datebook, written by Dr. Carol Butcher. I'm Ann Alquist.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding by Humanities North Dakota, North Dakota's largest lifelong learning community.
We'd like to thank the North Dakota Council on the Arts for supporting arts programming along with our members and other sources here on Prairie Public.
And that's a wrap for today's Main Street. Tomorrow at 3 p.m. Central, Prairie Public will air The Middle with host Jeremy Hobson. Jeremy asks the question that may be a bit different for you today than it was just a month ago. How do you feel about your choices in this election? And at 7 p.m. Central Friday, we'll air Science Friday with Ira Flato. Main Street will be back again Monday, and we hope you'll join us again. Until then, all of us here at Prairie Public hope you have a wonderful North Dakota weekend.